Like when the rocket hit it in the eye. In honor of Fly Me to the Moon, what's your favorite moon moment of cinema?
I'm Katie Rich, and some might say that the part of First Man where Ryan Gosling throws his daughter's bracelet into a moon crater is corny. I think it's great.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm going to go with Braveheart. You know, where they moon the army.
Oh, of course.
Nice.
Hey-o!
Hey, I guess I didn't specify the heliotropic body. I'm Dave with the Seven, and the thing that comes to mind for me is Tom Hanks covering the moon with his thumb with wonder as a full-on adult astronaut in Apollo 13.
Great scene.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going to go with the sequence from James Gray's Ad Astra when Brad Pitt goes to the moon, finds an Applebee's or Chili's, mm-hmm. whatever it might be.
Applebee's.
Realizes that wherever we go, we take ourselves with us, for better or worse.
It's really how I felt when I ate at an Applebee's for the first time in like 15 years, a couple weeks ago. Wherever you go, there's an Applebee's. What a relief. Oh. Yeah.
Come on the moon. It's 1999.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 479. It is the week of Wednesday, July 10th. That is the day that in 1981, Escape from New York, directed by John Carpenter and starring Kurt Russell and Donald Pleasance, premiered in the U.S. What would you give in this summer of not enough movie releases to have an Escape from New York just popping off?
So much.
What a good feeling that would be.
What does that mean? What type of movie?
There's like a good, fun action. I mean, like, Twisters is coming around the corner, but like it's been several weeks since A Quiet Place. I'm talking about. Like,
I get what you're talking about, but also A Quiet Place was that. We had to escape New York.
Sure.
2 weeks ago.
We'll get there. This weekend where the main release is, I guess, Fly Me to the Moon, mm-hmm. which as we were
and
just
long
discussing,
legs.
Doesn't appeal to any. And Long Legs, which I'm never seeing. Anyway, want more movies?
Katie wants a mulleted man with an eye patch to be running around looking muscular and tough and escaping from a major city.
I do think we need to revisit the idea of turning Democrat cities into prisons, though. I think now is the time for that idea really to resurge for action. Don't you think?
I didn't think we were going to get political on this episode, and then here comes Dave making New York City into a giant prison.
I think it was a good idea then, and you know mm-hmm. what's happened between then and now? Everything that keeps that a good idea.
When you authored Project 2025, did you regret putting your name on it now? I don't know. It seems like a choice.
I mean, it was bold to put my name on it then, and come December, it's going to be the smartest thing I ever did when you guys go up against the wall.
Oh my God.
I'm going to outlaw porn and arrest all of you. You just watch.
Did it say it was going to outlaw porn? I confess I didn't read.
Yes, it does. As our current sitting president tells us, maybe you should Google Project 2025. What a fucking tweet from that old fart. Anyway, politics.
I'm not going to Google it. I'm going to move.
I'll vote.
Okay. Everybody, please vote. There are probably elections near you that matter a lot. We'll get there. We have so much time to get there.
We will get there. They took Horizon off the charts. We have real tragedies to talk about.
Can we take the election off of the release schedule, like Horizon Part 2, just because it's bombing so hard?
We're not ready yet. You know, we need to give the audience time to see Part 1.
Can we replace it with a re-release of Escape from New York and then everybody's happy?
From what I've heard from the Supreme Court, we could do anything we want as long as we officially do it. So I say, like, let's fucking go.
In our official elected capacity as host of this podcast.
Yeah, what could we officially do? Let's do it.
Yep. All right. We're taking suggestions. You can maybe leave us suggestions in a review of this podcast, which apparently no one's been doing lately. David, over to you. David, the beautiful sounds of a microphone.
You may notice that I sound differently this week, I hope. I don't know. I sound the same to me. Still awful. But hopefully where you are, I sound a little bit better. Because at long last, after a short 11 years or so of doing this podcast, I did have a professional microphone, a Yeti microphone, at some point along the way. If you go back to the archives, probably in the Operation Kino days, you'll see. But it shat
well
the bed somewhere
10 years
along
ago.
The way. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But now
it is an Edison from 19 something.
Now, thanks to the generosity of my fellow podcast hosts,
two of them, not all three.
One who did nothing. I have a mm-hmm. refurbished blue microphone that allegedly works. So you can hear me clearly when I tell you that none of you left us reviews over the last few weeks. Shame.
They were waiting for you to sound
shame,
good.
Shame, shame. I could
not good enough.
I could go off about using Arishem in Marvel Snap, but frankly, I'm as bored of the subject as I am of using the card.
You think Arishem's coming back to the MCU? I don't want to detour
who is Arishem?
Too much, but
oh, he's from the
Eternals.
Fucking yeah,
he's
the
big,
guy
red
at the
man
end.
With a few
yeah.
eyes.
No, I like him. I kind of
is
I
he
kind
in the
of,
movie
like,
Eternals?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's
he
like
comes
the
down. He's
big guy at the end.
He's in the post credits. He like grabs people and brings them into space and says, "You're never coming back to this cinematic universe."
Wasn't Harry Styles in the post credits?
Yes, he was.
That too
with Pip the Troll. Of course,
there's a couple.
You love Pip the Troll.
What Patch is referring to as post credits is actually the last scene of the movie. And then what Katie's talking about is the post credits. Then there's a mid credits even.
10 lashes for me.
I saw Eternals for this podcast. I haven't forgotten it all.
You know what we have, though? We have emails because we've been saving them for some reason. So let's see what we can get through here. This first one comes from Andrew. The subject is review/why I love Napoleon. So here's the review part.
Here we go.
Long time listener, first time caller, but technically not that long time. I only started keeping up with weekly episodes this past year, which in addition to generally great pop culture and media discussions, has revealed to me the beauty of the back catalog. Case in point, I was happy to dig back a couple of years and find y'all's new to me discussion of The Northman, which I only got around to watching this past weekend. Great movie. Can't believe I slept on it as long as I did. Truly a spiritual Conan the Barbarian successor we deserve. I don't currently have an IRL group of people who are ready to jump into a discussion at a moment's notice, re the seashells dangling in front of Bjork's gouged out eyes, so it's a nice substitute to have the secondary satisfaction of listening to y'all casually slash passionately gab about movies and TV in a way that is both familiar and comforting. Thank you and keep up the great work. It feels like most entertainment podcasts set out and fail to achieve what you guys are doing through what is ostensibly your side pod. That's really impressive and a testament to each of you as professionals and as movie lovers. Best, Andrew. But there is a long PS about Napoleon Dynamite. Over the years, since I first saw it in middle school, Napoleon Dynamite has very slowly become one of my favorite movies. That's partially because with each rewatch, I can't help but miss the comedy and see it as a weird, poignant melodrama that ends up saying a lot about the world as it was changing at the turn of the century. In that sense, I think it 100% belongs in the general millennial canon, if not the elder millennial canon. Napoleon Dynamite is an uncanny mirror for the way rapid technology growth was preparing to upend the world in 2004 and prescient in the painting of the Odyssey of its Idaho weirdos as a bumbling quest to connect and reconcile with each other in the midst of that change. Sometimes overheating and cutting out all of their hair in the process. For all of the internet's innumerable faults, it does facilitate nice things like fighting in the war room, which is swell. I think it's the best way to watch Napoleon Dynamite in 2024. So, yeah. Patches. People are into it.
Did anyone realize that we talked about Napoleon Dynamite on, like, almost on the 20th anniversary of Napoleon Dynamite? To the point where there was a lot of, like, celebration that John Hader showed up on Jimmy Kimmel doing a fake Napoleon Dynamite bit with Kimmel's sidekick Guillermo, where Guillermo was playing Pablo as an older man.
Pedro.
Did John Hader say, God?
He did. Okay. He did. And it was also a SpawnCon ad
for T-Mobile.
Tater Tots.
For Tater Tots. It was Olay Tater Tots. You're absolutely correct. You nailed it.
I'm so glad that, I genuinely am glad that 20 years later, Napoleon Dynamite's getting... Napoleon Dynamite should pivot to branded content, or just
you
like
are,
all of this in general?
You are an ad man. You are a madman.
I don't think enough of a brand compared to Napoleon Dynamite to pull that off. Anyway, Dave.
You say anyway, like I'm not going to talk about Napoleon Dynamite again. This email's called A Quick Anecdote on Napoleon Dynamite.
Wow!
I mean, this is what happens when you save emails. I think we just have to read all the emails. Hey, Fitwer folks, big fan of the show. I enjoy listening every week to people who are legit dedicated and passionate about all things movies. And this is typically the soundtrack to my weekly bike rides and or washing dishes while recovering from a day of my two young kids, 4 and 2, yelling at me a lot.
Tell me about it.
Young family moments and such. I wanted to provide a quick note of context about your most recent Quarter Quell, specifically the Napoleon Dynamite discussion, and a little anecdote. Somebody mentioned offhandly that the appeal of the movie could have been partially been geographical, but that topic was moved on from rather quickly, so I thought to contribute. I grew up in the Midwest, but my extended family is almost exclusively from Utah. I moved here as an adult. Utah is a bizarre place for movie going because while most of the time nobody here goes to movies that aren't Pixar or Marvel, every once in a while the population will glom onto a movie and push it forward to make it a surprise box office juggernaut. The big two examples of that are Sound of Freedom, sorry, and The Greatest Showman, sorry again. Napoleon Dynamite, hey, however, is the movie. Grand idea of this weird phenomena. The entire population of the Mountain West states of Utah and Idaho suddenly were seen on screen, and they ate it up. The prime audience for this bizarre movie, my then 7-year-old grandmother, who lived her entire life on a farm south of Salt Lake City. My aunt took her to see it, and my grandmother loved it so much that she saw it again and again and again. The total confirmed count that we know of for the number of times that woman saw that movie in theaters was 12. Something about the movie connected with her so much that it was literally mentioned twice during her funeral last year. All this to say that the appeal of the movie, a movie I don't particularly love, to be clear, was generational, but it was also very much geographical. Anyway, great show, big fan, fun times. Thanks all, Mike.
Wow.
That's cool.
That's great. Cool. What a great funeral. It's mentioning Napoleon. I mean, I'm sorry that your grandmother has died, but wow. She sounds fascinating.
At least she spent her life doing what she loved, watching Napoleon Dynamite in theaters. yeah. But I don't know if I'm here for the shade to The Greatest Showman, the soundtrack of which we have been pumping in our kitchen every morning before school for the last several weeks. Brings the whole family together. It's a great get up and go.
Have you shown it to Asa?
We haven't, but I did show it to my lovely wife, who loved it. That movie
is
demented.
I feel like Asa might find it boring. I'm interested to see if you give it a shot.
I don't know if he's quite there yet. We will touch on Asa's current taste later in this episode. I don't know. I reread the review I wrote when that movie came out, and while I have been slightly endeared to it more than I was at the time, I more or less stand by my, like, this is insane and I enjoyed it review, but the music in that movie cannot be underestimated. And as I was sitting there thinking, it is insane to me that they have not brought this to Broadway yet. It feels so ready to just clean up and bring tourists in for years on end. I Googled and found that, of course, in December of last year, they announced that that is exactly what they plan on doing. And now the question is, will Hugh Jackman actually do a run when the show opens? Or maybe like a few months after the show opens and come in and revive ticket sales. I think it seems eminently within the realm of possibility. If he wants to, obviously.
My contribution to that is that every time there's a Peloton ride that's Broadway, they sneak in a Greatest Showman song, which is not accurate. Whoa. But like those songs are excellent riding a bike too.
They're excellent any circumstance in life.
This is me riding my bike.
I have never seen this movie.
Wow.
That surprises me.
You would probably like it. It feels demented in a way that jives with your general brain. And
in August, when we run out of new releases, maybe we need to do a Greatest Show.
Yeah, let's go back.
Did we ever do an episode on it? Probably not.
I just don't like Pasek and Paul. That's what's keeping me from this. I can't imagine liking the music. So I'm ready to take the plunge at some point.
I would love to know your thoughts on The Greatest Showman.
While we're here, we'll do this one last email, and I will save, I think, the other two for next week. This one, the subject is music taste and movies. My name is Peter, and I'm writing in all the way from Tasmania. Be sure to know I've left 5-star reviews where I can. I know you all appreciate that. Thank you, Peter. Back to your email. I started listening in 2021 because I loved the way David wrote about movies, and since then, my enjoyment for the show has grown to the extent that I listen and read work from all of you. At the end of episode 458, the one where you discussed the zone of interest, the outro music was Hello Sadness by Los Campesinos. The song grabbed me then. Since then, I've dived deep into the band's discography. I now consider myself a fan. This got me thinking about how movies have influenced my music taste. I'd say about half my favorite bands I've discovered from movies or trailers. For example, he gives some examples of The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, Lost in Translation, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, all having good music and trailers. He says I could skip these paragraphs. That's why I'm summarizing them. Those are just a few examples. My question to all of you is, did you discover any of your favorite bands/musicians from a movie or movie trailer? And if so, what are they? Warm regards, Peter B.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this recently, but...
Going back to the Garden State Marie Antoinette conversation.
The trailer from Marie Antoinette. I think I was definitely aware of New Order prior to seeing Marie Antoinette, but it, you know, sometimes it just takes one moment to sort of stick a needle in your brain and sort of, you know, catalyze a reaction to something that you've been exposed to before. And definitely it was a lightning bolt moment for me seeing that and the push of the edge I needed to become a obsessive New Order fan.
The Royal Tenenbaum soundtrack introduced me to Nico and like the entirety of the Velvet Underground. Like, I wouldn't call them my favorite band, but like there was just a lot of like songs in there. I mean, Cat Stevens is in there somewhere. Like, all a lot of Wes Anderson soundtracks.
Royal Tenenbaum's next millennial canon.
Absolutely.
Consideration.
It's got to go in there.
Not only is it a soundtrack that introduced me to a lot of musicians, but it's a makeout soundtrack.
We need to talk about Elder Millennial Canon amongst ourselves, because the plan was to do them like a couple times a year. So maybe we need to start
get there.
I don't remember signing off on that plan.
It's fine.
Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard. Not that it was. I had how I discovered Simon and Garfunkel, but great song.
Great
in that soundtrack.
Great album. I have a weird touchstone for this, or the one that immediately came to mind is that I really like the band Liars, because I heard their song "The Other Side of Mount Heart Attack," I think, off the top of my head, from the movie 50-50. Does anyone remember this?
Oh, yeah.
I know this group does, but like that's not a movie anyone talks about. I just don't know if it has any cultural legacy, but it's the movie with Joseph Gordon-Levitt getting cancer, Seth Rogen's his best friend.
I have a feeling it,
when he's trying to like
probably
get
some play among people
diagnosis.
Who have cancer.
I also use it in Cinematrix every now and then.
Sure.
Okay, there you go.
Very helpful.
That song plays at a very poignant moment, and I've kind of been obsessed with the song and the band ever since.
Hmm.
But I don't... No one talks about this movie.
No.
It came out at a time when comedy was such money in the bank at theaters, like the height of America's Rogan mania, that you could even release a one that was definitely... 50-50 is a generous split between comedy and drama in that movie. It was definitely more like 75-25, but it had Seth Rogen in it. And even though it was about cancer, people would go see it. Although I don't think they did. So maybe my whole thesis is upended. How did 50-50 do? Let's see. 50,
hang on, no, I was just going to quiz everybody. How much do you think 50-50 made domestic?
I think it made $20 million.
That seems low to me. 42.
Wow.
Right in the middle, 35.
No, domestic maybe, but it made all told, purely at the box office, $41.1 million off an $8 million budget. So,
where's the sequel?
I was guessing global.
I said domestic. Okay.
I don't have a band that became my favorite thing off of the trailer, but I do have two anecdotes I think connect to this. One is, every time there's a trailer with a track from Nine Inch Nails album The Fragile, I see the movie. It started with 300 and has continued, and they're at least somewhat fun. And then the Red Band trailer for a Serbian film had a loop from a track by a Serbian DJ rapper called Sky Wickla. And if it wasn't for that song getting stuck in my head, I would have never even tried Sky Wickla music. But that track, I think, is called Pazi Staradis, I'm going to guess. That's the Serbian film Red Band trailer. Nightmare synths that I had to look up.
Dave finding a way to bring up a Serbian film.
Yeah,
again.
Did not have that on my bingo.
If you want to email us, you can do so at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. We'll read it on the show and talk about it, even if it takes us a couple of weeks. We'll get there, but until then, on with the rest of the program.
It's the dream.
A perfectly fine conversation about a cat movie that I liked against my better judgment.
Yeah, Dave, I am a cat person. You are not a cat person. And yet you braved seeing A Quiet Place day one, which I guess like the cat's in the poster, but I don't think there's any way of knowing just how much this is a cat movie until you go to see it, which a lot of people did. It did very well. I was very heartened by the fact that it did very well. I was rooting for it even before I interviewed.
That the third movie in a franchise did well?
Yeah, Devin, you've seen what kind of grim summer we've been having? Aren't we all just like, I'm rooting.
Oh, we want movies to do well.
Okay. We want movies. Yes. Yeah. And like, I thought this is a good, in terms of like the third movie in a franchise, a prequel that like truly nobody asked for or really wanted or ever wondered what was going on in New York City at this time. It is a really interesting movie that is focused far more on people than on like effects or like big apocalyptic action, though there is some of that in there too. It's directed by Michael Sarnowski, who made Pig, which I'm imagining we talked about at some point, the, you know, Nicolas Cage revenge thriller that was actually a lot more meditative than that, kind of like The Bear for people who want things that are a little bit slower paced than The Bear. And then he kind of levels up to make this because John Krasinski like asked him to do it. It stars Lupita Nyong'o as this woman who, it is not a spoiler to say she has terminal cancer. That's like, you learn that in the first scene of the movie. And so when the Quiet Place aliens descend upon New York, she doesn't really want to survive. Her goal is not to make it through. Her goal is to get a slice of pizza from Patsy's in Harlem and bring her cat with her. Cat is named Frodo. Her name is Sam. Put it together from there. She eventually teams up with this kind of misty-eyed British guy played by Joseph Quinn, who I guess is on Stranger Things. I know nothing of him. I liked him in this.
He's going to be Johnny Storm in the Fantastic Four movie.
Thanks.
That's true. Both those facts are true.
He's also going to be in Gladiator 2, I saw.
All three of those facts are true.
It's a Quiet Place movie because it's got sequences of people trying to like tiptoe around aliens and getting creative about being quiet. It's got iffy New York geography. You know, there's some stuff where you're like, that doesn't make any sense of how that subway station wouldn't look like that. But it's short and it's snappy and it doesn't get hung up too much on a bunch of nonsense. Dave, I think in your Letterboxd review, you pointed out that the cat probably gets chased after too many times because the cat is smarter than everybody and will come back and they shouldn't do that. Fair enough. But I think it's kind of low on like, oh, we have to go get the thing. We got to go help these people. Like it's
your
about
description is making it sound awfully similar to my beloved Cloverfield. Should I
was going to say Inside Llewyn Davis.
It is incredibly similar to Cloverfield.
It does have some real Cloverfield.
If only they had opened with that, I would have made an effort to go see it. But.
Yeah.
Let me try to open
it's
this
a lion
a little bit, Katie, and then I'll throw back to you to get your opinion. I'll give you first opinion.
No, go for it.
This is the type of movie that I think we want when we talk about, landscape of things where it's hard for franchises to poke through, in that this is a Quiet Place movie in the sense that it has the Quiet Place alien in it. The premise and how it works as a movie, it could be anything. There's just a monster out to get you. That's why this works, is it's a movie underneath an archetype. There's not a moment that we have to cut to whatever John Krasinski's
family
is doing.
It's not expanding the lore of
there
the
is
world.
One
it's
character.
Just like, what else is happening when this
well, that's
is,
frustrating
this
because the reason that I was disinclined to see it is because it is a Quiet Place movie. I was very unimpressed by the first two and more or less done with this franchise, even though I was excited. I loved Pig and I was excited to see what Michael Sarnowski could do. You know, it was similar to like Lee Isaac Chung directing Twisters, directing Minari. But the Quiet Place of it all was a huge turnoff. If it had been called anything else and given me that Cloverfield vibe, I would have been there day one.
I'll wait because I promised to throw to Katie. Katie, what did you think overall of A Quiet Place day one?
I had a great time. I had seen the other two Quiet Place movies at some point always at home because it was scary. And I was like, I liked them fine. Like they were never high on any list for me. But seeing this in a theater, like not especially crowded, but not really knowing that much about where the story was going to go, like being, you know, not knowing how much the cat was going to be present in it. I just was really along for like all of the twists and the tension and the way that it built the relationship. And, you know, this relationship between Lupita Nyong'o and Joseph Quinn as these kind of like unlikely companions. Like for a while, I think he shows up and you're like, yeah, she doesn't need anybody. She's Lupita Nyong'o. Her eyes tell an entire story. But they kind of develop a rapport over the course of it. And then, you know, I don't want to spoil the ending. I want David and Patches to go see it, but it ends really well. I think it sends you out with this sense of like weird triumph at, like, triumph at the filmmaking. Like, you're kind of impressed by how he's managed to get it to the point that it is. And any movie that kind of can end on a high note like that, I think you're going to come out of it and be like, hey, everybody, go see it, which is what I'm
there
doing.
There are
right
movies
now,
that begin with Nina Simone's feeling good, and there are movies that end with Nina Simone's feeling good. Wow. The Quiet Place is one of those.
Perfect Days also is one of them.
Pop up going, just good news, guys. Let's just talk about good news. Does he do that?
No, he does that in If, though, which maybe I'll get to later.
We'll get there. I actually have a real question.
Yeah.
I am fascinated by Lupita Nyong'o. I feel like we probably have this conversation anytime she pops in a movie, which is very rarely. Mm-hmm. Maybe the most
she's got shit to do, man.
Famous. What?
She's got shit to do.
She probably does have shit to do. I'm just fascinated by her. I'm like, I want to know specifically how you feel about her in this movie. If she's like good, because obviously she won an Oscar for one of her first movies, 12 Years a Slave. That was in more than 10 years ago now. She hasn't been in that many movies, and she's been in a lot of bad movies, but I would still think of her as like a pretty great actor. I love her in Us, you know? But I'm now looking at, I'm like, the 355? Absolutely not. Yeah. Rise of Skywalker? No.
I mean,
like, she doesn't do a lot of movies, but, like, is she a great actress?
The Black Panther movies, and then voice
this
roles,
is the movie
pretty
she
much
made.
Entirely.
This is one of the very few movies she has decided to make.
I really wish her character name were coming to me in this moment. It isn't. It probably never will. But you were forgetting about her immortal performance in Star Wars The Force Awakens.
Maz Kanata, I believe, is who you're speaking of. I think it's mocap.
Oh, that wasn't actually...
I think it's mocap.
Fine. Yeah. No, she's great in this movie.
She showed up.
She's really good as like kind of like that silent film actor thing of doing a lot with her face and her eyes. And, you know, there's kind of a shot in the trailer where she's covered in dust. So it really is just her eyes kind of popping up out of it. And she's playing a character who's kind of prickly and doesn't really want to be around anybody but her cat, but is so compelling, I think, because she's Lupita Nyong'o and because she kind of finds the layers in that without being like an overly sympathetic cancer patient. She's just like a person who's kind of a jerk who happens to have cancer and wants to go get a piece of pizza. I don't think a lot of actors could carry that role as well as she does. Like, they were really smart to build the movie around her in that way.
Maybe we don't have enough like Hitchcockian thrillers. Lupita Nyong'o, and that is her calling, and that is why she was correct to work with Jean Collet Serra in Nonstop, which I think was her follow-up.
I mean,
I think she shot that before 12 Years a Slave came out.
I think she could be like a Hitchcockian figure, right?
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Or like Wait Until Dark, which is another like half silent, or no, she plays someone blind in Wait Until Audrey Hepburn. Anyway, yes, I think
like
that's
a horror
idea.
Icon, weirdly. But I mean, she's just not in that many movies.
Yeah. I think the strong point of this movie is it is much more part of something where the goal of the movie is, can these people survive getting across a version of New York City? It is much more Warriors Escape from New York, Cloverfield, than it is a Quiet Place movie, because as Katie or Patches mentioned, somebody mentioned, there's no lore here. You're not going to learn something new about the Quiet Place monsters, which I believe is part of A Quiet Place and A Quiet Place Part 2. To be fair, I haven't seen Part 2 its entirety.
Yeah, well, part two kind of reveals that they can't swim, I think.
Oh, there we go.
Fascinating.
yes.
I mean, I think
which
it sounds...
Which is important in this one,
but
eventually.
I think it sounds like they're playing to the strengths of the franchise, because aliens have been deeply uninteresting since the beginning. I mean, like, the design was very uninspired.
They're like teeny Cloverfield.
And they're the big gray things with the long spindly limbs. And just very, classic. Very little creativity at work. This movie sounds like it made a very wise choice to sort of move away from caring about them. If only it could have actually just introduced a new alien, I'm sure they would have. But it sounds like the emphasis is less on shit jumping out at you as it was the previous two movies and more on suspense. Is that true?
It's kind of bifurcated where, like, because we begin and the aliens haven't got here yet and they need to, you know, very quickly invade. So the first half of the movie...
But they're not invading. Let me asterisk this. The thing that the movies reveal is that they do not... This is not an invasion.
They're
it's
like
not
refugees.
On purpose. They're on, like, they're riding an asteroid and they hit the Earth. And like, we're just critters, you know? Like, they are not... They have no intention. They are just wild beasts repopulating.
Yes, they did not seem capable of interstellar travel
to me. That's why you can't expand the lore, because there is no society to them. They're not traveling here like War of the Worlds. They're just accidentally winding up here.
I mean, maybe it does expand the lore. I don't know how important it is. They seem to eat an alien egg at some point. But we're focused on the cat, which has run away, so that's why you don't pay attention to the alien egg. Anyway, this movie has this division point. I didn't really like the first half, which is sort of like establishing that there has to be this invasion or meteor shower of panicked animals, however you would like me to put it, Patches. That is like kind of too PG-13-y for my like. There's some like very bloodless violence when in the initial sort of torrent. She gets knocked out like at season one of Game of Thrones to save some money. She wakes up again, and some of the characters she makes like basically like acts really early on in the movie. Someone gets accidentally killed trying to keep them quiet, and I'm like, oh, this movie doesn't know what it's doing. And then halfway through, once the Joseph Quinn character kind of shows up, I'm like, oh no, this movie just was hiding its intentions. Mm. And once I have the time to realize which characters I'm supposed to focus on, both of the Lupita Nyong'o character and the Quinn character really flourish in that last half in a way that is amazing, considering they mostly can't talk to each other.
Yeah,
I think it was really smart to have a drama director that's good at small moments come into here, because by the time they, you know, get to one of the locations they want to get to and have a moment to just relax and be with each other, but they still have to do it silently, it's a beautiful little sequence that would have been great in whatever movie it showed up in. So
yeah, some Nat great Wolf stuff in plays one of those early characters who's also in Pig, so that was kind of nice to see him back. I thought he was great in the beginning of the movie. I guess I didn't like think that he was going to be around the whole time, so I wasn't as hung up on it. But you're right that like the invasion is kind of like more like Day After Tomorrow than anything else that comes after that.
Right, but then like literally as just you're like, oh man, how's she gonna get out of this weather? It's like she gets knocked out and someone saves her. That's how she gets out of that one. And I thought the movie, just because of its title, I think the thing that maybe stopped David and Patches from seeing it, I thought it was going to be a Quiet Place movie, and it's not. It's, I wouldn't, if you were in New York when the apocalypse came, wouldn't you try to get the last slice of good pizza that was ever going to be made on Earth? And The Quiet Place Day One asked that question.
It does feel like something you might do.
To wrap up, do you think we would keep the podcast going if Quiet Place aliens arrived?
We would risk the aliens coming to attack us by talking into a microphone.
Would we whisper into the microphones like this?
We'd have to just sit by a waterfall. And
I did have a thought, which is, if you wanted two patches, we could provide a service, which is we broadcast the fighting in the war room endlessly to be used as a distraction. So you just turn on your portable radio, you put it to the fighting in the war room
that
channel,
is a
and you
really
throw
good,
it.
You're why isn't there like a big micro or a big speaker?
I think that's literally what happens at the end of A Quiet Place Part 2.
There also is in this movie, the military communicates New Yorkers by flying over them with huge speakers. And basically they're like, stay inside. And they're also drawing like all the aliens along with them. It works. Quiet Place, Day One, in theaters now. Better than it should have been is my verdict.
Yep, I liked it a lot.
Ooh, and I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel.
Sure. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I shat all over Inside Out 2 on this very podcast.
I would say that was certainly you.
$1.25 billion grossing Inside Out 2.
A movie that I basically loathed when I had only had to see it once. But being the father of the year that I am, I did not let my personal feelings get in the way of my son's, I want to say enjoyment, like just having something to do, a nice experience, you know, for the two of us to do on a Saturday afternoon. And I really went out of my way, despite knowing what my fate would be and how much it would pain me, to sort of lay the groundwork and indoctrinate him into Inside Out 2, just because I wanted to take him to the movies, and it seemed like my only option. So I showed him Inside Out 1, and he started watching YouTubes about Inside Out 2, and he knew all of the characters long before we got there, knew all about anxiety in ways that I didn't learn about until I was 13 years old. We, on a very, very hot and somewhat rainy Saturday afternoon, went to the Lower Manhattan Alamo Drafthouse, took a picture of Asa with the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, and we saw Inside Out Part 2, a movie that I enjoyed even less the second time, and felt like, you know, I'm not surprised that it's such an enormous hit, but I It clearly does not resonate with 4-year-olds. It was not intended for them. They're not the target audience, but it is inaccessible to them in a way that I would venture almost every other Pixar movie, well, good, bad, or anyone between.
My 5-year-old right. loved it.
My five-year-old also loved it.
Love, hate, or anywhere in between is irrelevant to me. I'm just talking about like the level which it's speaking to them. I just don't think there is a lot for kids of that age to hang on to in this movie. Whereas I think there is a ton. The other, I mean, there's not like a lot of fun slapstick. I mean, beyond the themes of the characters and what's at work. I mean, the themes are the characters of this movie, as I enumerated in our instead of two episode. But there's just not a lot of like visual splendor to hold on to. It's not a lot of fun. Asa, fortunately, has also been indoctrinated to love hockey, so like that carried him a little bit of the way. He mustered when the movie was over. The most half-hearted, that was the greatest movie I've ever been to, you've ever heard in your life. But he also, this was the first time, and I credit this more to his age than I do to the film, and to the giant box of Sour Patch Kids that he ate all of over the course of the movie, that he did not...
That's why you go to movies.
Sure, I mean, yeah, I mean, I will take what... I mean, this is the thing. It's like, I don't care what we're seeing. I just want him to have a good time. I want him to have positive associations with going to the movies. That's the indoctrination that I really want to have. And I want to have the fun, the nice time, like taking him to my house of worship, effectively, and enjoying a weekend afternoon together. I continue to have nothing all that nice to say about the movie. I could tell that he was sort of disengaged from it as we were watching it in a way that even when he was younger, he was a year younger, we saw Toy Story 2 or even Elemental last summer when he was like trying to cut my head off with the little table tray that spins 300 degrees around. And he was laughing his head off as he did that and ignoring the star-crossed romance between fire and water. But he was more engaged when he was engaged in those movies than he ever was in Inside Out 2. But he sat throughout the whole thing. He was very proud of himself for that. And I have no regrets about taking him to the movie. It was a really nice memory for both of us.
Core memory. That's going to form his personality. Core memory,
Jesus Christ. Right. He's like, anxiety showed up. I was like, hey, so this anxiety. And he's like, I know all about anxiety. I was like, okay, buddy. But we had a lovely time.
May I recommend to you taking a child with an ear infection who is very tired and not sleeping very well and doesn't have a lot of energy to do anything to see Despicable Me 4, which I think if you ask my children today, three days after we saw it, could tell you nothing about what happened in that movie. That movie is like air. It is there. It is mildly entertaining the entire time, and you will forget you ever saw it the minute you walk out. And maybe that's okay. I think, according to Charlie, who has seen all the Despicable Me movies without me, I think at after school, I have no idea. He says it's the worst of the movies he's ever seen. But as far as I can tell, they're all exactly like this. I feel like it will make you appreciate Inside Out 2 more. You can still hate it, but at least it's something. At least it has like a substance to it. Does that connect
to you? It's funny that you say that because I was seriously considering. I've never seen any of the Despicable Me movies. And as listeners to this podcast should know by now, the Minions are my mortal enemies. But I thought that the swill-like nature of like the lowest common denominator, eat your Walmart trash aesthetic of Illumination Entertainment would be just what the doctor ordered for Asa, you know, whether that had some long-term detriment for my life, you know, whether it was going to turn him into a hyper cartoon hitting machine, because his sense of humor does seem to dovetail with the Minions probably more than I would like at this point. But at the end of the day, I don't know. I mean, he seemed to... He responded well to, even though he like didn't really understand the premise of Inside Out, he responded well to, I think, the concept of like boning up on it so that we could go see the sequel, and took his homework seriously. And so I was like, okay, I guess we're doing Inside Out 2. And hearing your report on the Despicable Me 4, I think we're going to pass on that one. Although he did see a YouTube commercial for Despicable Me 4 in the middle of one of the shows he watches. And he was like, he seems like he goes completely... you know, glass-eyed when a commercial comes up and he just like waits out, you know? But for this one, for the first time possibly ever, he turned to me and he was like, I want to see that. And I was like, you do not.
My magic trick when we were with all of the cousins last week and trying to get five kids to agree on something was that I just found on actual cable that Zootopia was on. I didn't say anything and I just put it on. And the commercials lure them in because they are fascinated by commercials. And then they all just sat down and watched Zootopia. And that was it. Nobody said a word. It was great.
The commercials.
Sure, your kids cable.
But you know what? you know what? Taking your kids to the movie is fucking great.
It is
great. And so far, Asa, you know, his eyes light up when you tell him that you're going to go. And I just wish that Hollywood would give us more opportunity to do that. I mean, we're lucky in New York that there are
David if it's still playing in theaters, as I learned by seeing it today. So
I'm just hoping that Hollywood gives us more opportunities to go to the movies.
I would like other opportunities, please.
More John Krasinski content.
But yeah, so that's not happening. But the movies, what a concept.
Dash, did you take Eleanor to see Inside Out too?
Oh yeah, Eleanor see it twice.
Wow. Yeah. We saw it again with my dad when we were naked, so I've also seen Inside Out 2 twice.
I feel like Inside Out 2 is the movie of the heat.
I've seen
not
so
enough people are talking about that if it's 95 degrees out, movies do better.
I've seen the trailer for Transformers 1 so many times.
I say stupid about this. Every time people are like laughing and clapping during the Transformers 1. It looks so awful, but I wonder if it'll be a big hit.
My kids want to see it. Of course they do. They also want to see Harold and the Purple Crayon. So,
did you guys see the trailer?
I'm not going to that movie.
Did you guys see the trailer for the Pharrell Williams?
Oh yeah, they want to see
the Lego documentary.
It's like a Trojan horse. Like you lure the kids in with the Legos. It's so crazy.
That is the craziest thing. Universal acquires the license to Lego. Doesn't do a Lego movie, does a Pharrell biopic in Lego. I just think that's absolutely nuts.
It's not a biopic, it's though. Awesome. My understanding is it's like, you know, directed by Morgan Neville. I feel like it's more of a documentary than anything else.
Oh, no, yeah, it's supposed to be a documentary, but all the footage is Lego, right?
Huh.
It's crazy. Awesome.
I think we might see it, and it's going to bore them so much. It's going to be.
They love Pharrell. What are you talking about? They love he's connected to Despicable Me.
They don't like Despicable Me that much.
The heat is truly on. It's like 95 degrees. Dave, you don't live on the East Coast. What is the temperature where you live? Is it not just 95 degrees every single day?
I mean, sometimes it is, and other times we get blessed cloud cover and wind, and it's, you know, fine. It's only 87 degrees. It's hot everywhere.
Goddamn hot. I hate you people who don't think climate change is real. What's wrong with you? But
it's really hot.
It's so hot. But if you stayed inside, maybe you watched a new movie called Beverly Hills Cop Axel F. This is an I find this astonishing.
Why is it not Beverly Hills Cop AF, Patches?
Why isn't it Beverly Hills Cop AF? I mean, why isn't Beverly Hills Cop 4 when all the other Beverly Hills Cops have Roman numerals in them? I don't. Is it because of Rambo? Is it because of, like, you just make things, the legacy sequels are now.
Do you know that the song, that the title of the song that Dave and I were just singing is Axel F? This is what
that
you
is
learned.
The original Harold.
That's what it's called. That's what the subtitles tell you is playing when you watch on closed captions.
Yes.
Which is how I did.
Axel F has a legacy too. This is Eddie Murphy back as Axel Foley in a Beverly Hills Cop movie that took, I think, like 20 years to develop. This is not a new project by any means. Paramount Pictures was going to make this movie for ages and ages and ages. They shot a pilot for a Beverly Hills Cop television show where Eddie Murphy showed up as the dad of, like, his kid was going to be the new Axel Jr.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be like a CBS sitcom/drama kind of thing. That didn't take. So more development, more, you know, the guys who made all these new Bad Boys movies were going to direct Beverly Hills Cop 4. That never happened. And now Netflix swooped in, I guess, looking for IP that would attract people to the platform. And they threw $150 million.
Where did that money go? Truly.
We'll get there.
Did you say 350 million?
No, this isn't Jupiter Ascending, which is a reference in Beverly Hills Cop.
Yes.
I'm extremely curious.
One plus star for making an extended Jupiter Ascending joke in this movie. $150 million. David, they crashed so many cars in this movie. There's helicopters flying around. There are quite a bit of
Eddie Murphy, on a related note, got paid $149 million for this movie.
Very possible. I mean, Netflix swooped in and decided, like, this was the gamble to get actual IP on the platform doing this legacy sequel. This would bring people in. Long gestating project. This guy, Mark Malloy, he has never made a movie. He has done a lot of commercials. He's done a lot of, he did a Quibi. But this is his first movie. And I find the whole thing, like, pretty fascinating. It is partially pastiche of these old 80s, you know, Martin Brest, Beverly Hills Cop. It's kind of a fusion of all three. Like, it has that balanced comedy. You know, some of the entries have gone to comedy. Weirdly, the Tony Scott, Beverly Hills Cop 2 is funnier than, like, John Landis stepping in and doing three, a notable disaster. Beverly Hills Cop, that original, just kind of the perfect balance, really trying to harken back to that. I guess my question to you guys is, do you give a shit about Beverly Hills Cop? We're all millennials, as we've gone on and on and on about in a Court of Quell recently. I think this is more of like a Gen X nostalgia property, but wondering if, like, seeing Eddie Murphy back in a role where he's just mouthing off as Eddie Murphy, doing his Eddie Murphy thing, having the splash of action, is this like, and you had to watch this at home. Obviously, this is not playing in theaters because this is Netflix. So you're watching this like you're repeating it on cable immediately. Is it fun? Is it like, is that what Beverly Hills Cop is? A movie you watched a million times on cable, and now the joy of it is catching the legacy sequel, quote Matt Singer's term there, on instant cable, Netflix, and seeing Eddie Murphy back in the saddle. Like, I don't know what the joy is here, but I guess to cut to my chase, is like, I kind of enjoyed it. It is.
You don't know what the joy is, but you found the joy anyway.
Is this hashtag content or is it a real movie? Is this like, how do I even decide what a Netflix movie is at this point?
It is definitely hashtag content. However, it is above par hashtag content, would be my argument.
This is not the Adam Project or Red Notice with Ryan Reynolds, right? Yeah. This is not brand.
I begrudgingly sat through it. I enjoyed parts of it, particularly the first 30 minutes. I think that the first 15 minutes, 10 minutes, however long it is, in Detroit is like exactly what I wanted this movie to be. It like makes no bones about, you know, making the nostalgia play.
First off, starts off with hockey.
We'll get there.
David's like, how again.
There was another movie in very recent memory that started with a hockey game that I did not care for. We've talked about it on this episode. So that only moves the needle so far. But that first sequence is great. I mean, people robbing the Detroit Red Wings locker room during an NHL game, him busting up his hilarious line about how he didn't actually win the Stanley Cup 6 times. I mean, and there's a great snowplow chase. I mean, it's vintage from the soundtrack to the look of it, everything. It's vintage Beverly Hills Cop, and Eddie Murphy is totally in the pocket and grooving on the character. And it feels like no time has passed. He also looks fantastic, which helps. But as soon as he goes to Beverly Hills Cop, as soon as he goes to Beverly Hills, rather, you can start to feel the wheels come off a little bit and the cheapness settle in and the movie sort of strain for a reason to exist. And his relationship with his daughter, which is the emotional anchor to it, is dead on arrival, which didn't really help for me. And then they introduced Joseph Gordon-Levitt and I was like, oh, I guess he's got a cameo in this thing. And then they're like, wait, no, he's a main character. He's the other main character. I just couldn't really.
They also hired him for the 500 Days of Summer emotional arc, which is he's in love with Eddie Murphy's daughter, Axel's daughter, in this, and they're like, he's still wearing vests and still trying to romance women. Like, that's his role in everything. I couldn't help but think back to our 500 Days of Summer. He cannot escape this.
This would have been a perfect Beverly Hills Cop movie in 2004, and I'm surprised how little has changed in its presentation from a movie that they should have made in 2004. Maybe like shuffle around some characters ever, but this isn't a legacy sequel. It doesn't feel as much like a legacy sequel or a legacy sequel because the new leads aren't strong. There is a part of this movie that has me think that they're even thinking about a Taylor Page, Joseph Gordon-Levitt spinoff. Like, there's just not enough there for their plots. What this does feel like is like what Beverly Hills Cop 2 or Beverly Hills Cop 3 feels like. And I'm sure they would have loved to make it in 2004, so that would have been 10 years since 1994, which is Beverly Hills Cop 3, which this movie kind of wants to encourage you to think that never happens. They're like, oh, the third one, that one was bad. And I'm like, okay, movie, if I need to have internal logic of what Beverly Hills Cop movies are good and bad so you could prove that you're a good one, I guess you're fine. It's just the premise has been defanged, but this version of Black Detroit Cop Goes to Beverly Hills is the exact same sort of optics that it would have been in the 80s, but it can't make any of the like racist jokes or any of the yuppie jokes.
Well, it's fun that he is now a fish out of water in the world that Beverly Hills Cop hath wrought, right? Like, all the cops he meets are black women, first of all. Yes. And they have no patience for his bullshit. And it's really funny in short spurts. I mean, it's moderately funny anyway. I mean, like, it's funny and it's clever enough that they throw back the same fish out of water element, like right back at him, like all the same energy and the tactics that he brought to it, you know, playing on these rubes who were there in the 80s, who had never interacted with black law enforcement before. Like, now none of that shit works because he doesn't know how to navigate that world because there are so many people who, you know, were able to follow in his footsteps. And that is interesting.
He can't make people uncomfortable. He cannot bullshit his way into any room. And at one point, he's just like, I give up on this. I'll pay.
Yeah. I think it loses a little bit in that because I do think Eddie Murphy, maybe with, you know, I don't know how much he improvises, but maybe with like some more writing could have really made a meal out of this and like the differences. But there are things like, you know, you guys are talking about where every cop he meets is like a black female cop, which I appreciate as like the passage of time. But then they're like, you know, I know a good cop when I see a good cop, Axel. And I'm like, what fucking decade is this from? So,
well, the cops are still going to be, I mean, even though the cop is also, the bad guy is also a cop in this movie. Yes. The cops are still going to be the good guys. I mean, Beverly Hills Cop is not going to go full ACAB on you. you need to adjust your expectations accordingly.
No, but it's not even doing something cool, like talking about how like the older characters have that mindset and the younger characters don't. There are only the older characters, and all of the older characters, Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Taylor Page, who are not in, are all the people involved, the new characters involved with the older characters, all just know the entire backstory. They have also seen Beverly Hills Cop 1 through 3. And then they don't have really that much to maneuver around it, which is why Taylor Page, all of her scenes with her dad are the same note like four times until at the end, Eddie Murphy gets to turn around and be like, you know what? You were right about that. I'm going to listen to you from now on. And I'm like, cool. That could have been a conversation at any point in the past 15 years.
This movie eventually, once it really sort of gets into the meat of what it's doing, lives and dies on the strength of the relationship. They're very estranged. He's been a completely delinquent father. He got divorced to her mother and stayed in Detroit and wanted to focus on his job that he cared more about than he did his daughter. And they try to make amends over the course of this movie. It's interesting. Like, she is working on the opposite side of the law. It's sort of an act of rebellion to him. She is a defense attorney, defending the people that he wants to put in jail. But she also has his his wit and his street smarts, and we get to see some of that. But, you know, Taylor Page, who I thought was excellent, her recessive energy, it was excellent for Zola, where she was the avatar of the story, where she sort of needed to sort of be in the background, being our eyes into that story. It is all wrong for this particular character. She is not bringing the energy to the movie that they need. I don't know if it's necessarily her fault, or I think that some, you know, maybe the director, who has never made a film before, wasn't easily able to clock or have the chutzpah to be like, you need to go toe-to-toe with Eddie Murphy to make this work. But he just sort of runs over her during their scenes together. It's very unengaging. Joseph Gordon-Levitt suffers much the same fate. I mean, he doesn't have the answer for that either, so I don't want to throw it all at Taylor Page's feet.
I thought he was pretty good in the scene bad. Where he has to like fly a helicopter at some point.
That scene
he used to be a helicopter pilot.
It's moderately amusing because it's like the only scene where they really get to sort of
he needs to get
flustered. Yeah, they need when they can both get flustered together, and it's fun. And that is where Other than Eddie Murphy, the lion's share of the budget seems to have gone. This helicopter chased right down one of the main boulevards of Los Angeles. But it is moderately well put together. And then it ends and the movie sort of becomes somnambulant again and just sort of shuffles along, hitting its marks.
I did want to ask, do you guys, maybe this is because I was watching a lot of Murder, She Wrote in the lead up to watching.
When are you not watching a lot of Murder, She Wrote?
This is my problem. I understand that. But I just could not follow what the problem was. Movie, what is the crime being committed? What is the case he's solving?
Kevin
Bacon, I know you're a bad cop, but
I
have no idea what's going on.
It is so needlessly
convoluted
for something that boils down to there's a crooked cop. But yeah, the SD card is the fucking MacGuffin that they talk about in a way that doesn't it always feels more complicated and worth investing in than it is. And you never really know where the SD card started, and there just isn't a strong enough hook even to buy it as a MacGuffin. But where the plot is just the cops are crooked and working with the cartels, it makes no sense.
The most egregious part to me was the MacGuffin is introduced at the same time as Judge Reinhold, who gets kidnapped with the SD card. Just do the kidnapping. I don't understand. The SD card is the one part of the plot that doesn't make it feel like it was made for 1994. But other than that, it is so they don't have a reason to do a stakeout in the movie, which is why the final scene of Axel or Beverly Hills Cop Axel F is what it is. They really bypass all modern policing. Nobody's doing 24 computer searches for anybody's face prints on security cameras or anything. They're just he works for his Hispanic uncle that's played by Luis Guzman, who wears glitter and hangs out at a karaoke bar. And we're just cool. This movie would have been better in 2004 with Gabriel Union or Zoe Saldana bouncing off of Eddie Murphy than it is in this one, because it's almost like there's the original cast and a new cast that is here, but is not a comedic cast, which I think would have helped a little bit so that Murphy had some things to bounce off of. But that being said, those are the things I had problem with the movie. Overall, when it ended, Java's like, did you like that? I'm like, you know what? It's fine. They don't make them like this anymore. So it was kind of fun to watch it work, to watch the gears sort of click, and to watch a protagonist sort of effortlessly drift through the movie, having not learned anything since 1994 about how police work works. Why not?
I mean, it's pretty well made.
Yeah, it's about as good as you can hope for a Netflix original.
It's pretty well edited.
Mark Malloy's got it, but he directed this movie. I mean, it's competent. Yeah. It's funny. It's it could be bungled. I guess it could have gone much worse. And they crash real cars. I can't say enough about crashing real cars.
I wasn't super thrilled with how this movie looked, but I do think it was saved sort of by its editing and by its soundtrack, which at one point has downtrodden version of Axel F that just made me laugh when it started.
Yeah, trailer core, but in the movie.
And I'm like, oh, he's sad. Axel F is sad. Beverly Hills Cop, Axel F. It's on Netflix.
Did Katie like this? I didn't hear Katie.
I didn't see Axel F. I watched Beverly Hills Cop. It's on Netflix, too. One. You know what's a great time is watching Beverly Hills Cop on Netflix.
Yeah. Katie, how's Beverly Hills Cop?
I recommend watching it after Axel F.
I was so sad there wasn't a banana in the tailpipe in Axel F. That was
you would
something
think
I felt.
That would be what they would immediately do.
Reinhold gets more time in Clerks the Animated Series than he does in Beverly Hills Cop. Axel F. And that is a genre.
Well, he gets a lot of time in Beverly Hills Cop and is extremely funny. I mean, coming out of Beverly Hills Cop and talking about anyone being funny besides Eddie Murphy feels beside the point. But I think what makes it such a delight is Eddie Murphy's on 100 layers above everybody. But Judge Reinhold, the other cop who he's with, are keeping up. The woman who plays his friend who works at the art gallery, she's really great. I know there's the tortured history of how the movie came to be and how it was going to be a Sylvester Stallone thing. But I don't really know enough to see the weirdness there. It feels like Eddie Murphy just kind of takes that thing and runs away with it.
Oh, that's why it was so good. He completely hijacked it for the better.
I had no nostalgia for it at all. I just had never seen it as a kid. I've never seen any of the Beverly Hills Cops. And I knew we were going to talk about this and figured I may as well watch the original. And Yeah, kind of stupid. The plot doesn't really matter, but the strip club heist stakeout thing is one of the best scenes in movies, maybe? had a great time. It sounds like it's more fun to watch the original on Netflix than to watch Axel F. on Netflix.
I think Axel F. is worthy, at okay. least.
I mean that's better than we hoped for, mouth. Right?
You know what? I think it might be better than 3, actually. If we're like, oh, it's not sure. the worst.
It is definitely
Beverly Hills.
Better than 3.
It's not the... It maybe is at par 2. It's been a while.
I got two cavities filled today, and it was better than 3. Especially because I was watching Dumb Money on the ceiling of my dentist's office. But
so it's definitely far from the worst Beverly Hills Cop. And it does have some really, I think, admirable things about it. Yeah, I just don't know if it's going to be like cinema we're discussing for much longer than this month. But, you know... Prove me wrong. Beverly Hills Cop, Axel left.
That does it for this week's show. We'll be back next week. It sounds like it's going to be a long in the works sequel time because we're going to be talking about Twisters.
Yay!
Ahead of its release, and maybe some other stuff as well. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patchett, executive editor of Polygon. I am on Blue Sky and Letterboxd at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to all the old episodes. As one of our reviewers said, backlog great. If you know what movies we're talking about, if you went back and watched them, go find the movie that in the last 10 years we probably talked about it. fightinginthewarroom.com.
I am David Ehrlich. I'm coming to you live on a brand new microphone. I hope the sound of my voice is at least slightly less irritating than usual. You can find me on all the usual places. Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, others. At David Ehrlich, you can find us all together in one happy place on the Apple Podcast app. At Fighting in the War Room, leave us a review. We'll read it live on the show. Otherwise, I'm going to have to talk about the Deadpool takeover of Marvel Snap, which is a reality I don't even want to confront in the game. So let's not
do
that. Also, I could pivot to the Elden Ring DLC as a topic. I got things, topics of conversation there that could last for days. So, choose your poison.
Or you can email us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can follow me on Twitter, Letterboxd, and Blue Sky at DS7E. You can listen to me on the Trial by Content podcast. We're covering House of the Dragon. And please do leave us reviews, because I'm still playing Star Wars Galaxy of Heroes. They're going to introduce another large-sized unit, and it's the three witches of Dathomir from Ahsoka. Things are happening. But more importantly, I'm going to unlock my first in-game Stellan Skarsgård soon, so I'm willing to talk about it. Please leave us a review on the Apple Podcast app.
I am Katie Rich. I'm not following Tears of the Kingdom closely enough to really have any boring Zelda stuff to bring to the table right now, but I'm going to work on it. So they have some threats. In the meantime, find me at The Ankler on the Prestige Junkie podcast and newsletter. I talked to Coleman Domingo about Sing Sing this week. Great movie out this week. Everyone go see it. I'm on Twitter and Letterboxd at Katie Rich and on Instagram at Katie Rich Talking. You can find us all on Twitter and Blue Sky at FITWR, where you can tell us what else you watch on Netflix other than Axel F. That was maybe a more fun time, or even if Axel F. is worthy a more fun time, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of Fly Me to the Moon, what's your favorite moon moment of cinema?
Thanks for listening. We'll be back talking to you next week.